Okay, first I'm going to ask, what first got you into music?
I was born into a musical family. My father was a professional jazz musician, and a very successful one. Actually, one of his bands were the first British band to have a number one single on the British chart. They'd all been American before then. That was a band called the Stargazers. And then he was in another band called the Polka Dots, and they sang on I Am the Walrus and the Long and Winding Road, Beatles records, of course. They sang with Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, a lot of great people. And so that was a big influence on me, without a doubt. But, you know, just because you've got a father who's in music doesn't mean that you're going to naturally forge a path in that world yourself. It's just something that I felt compelled to do. And there's other reasons I can get into, but the long and short of it is that.
Okay, do you feel that your dad being a musician, do you think that helped you in choosing your career of going into music?
Well, I think it, put it this way, I think it made me be quite, it was a combination of idealism and realism. Idealism because if you want to be in music, you have to be idealistic to a degree, because the chances of being able to sustain yourself in this world are pretty small. A lot of people want to do it, a lot of people love music, but there's not room for everyone to do so well. That's the idealism. The realism is actually the same thing in some ways, is that you have to prepare yourself that it's going to be tough at times. And my dad had to go through that. When the Beatles came about and the Kinks and the Who, you know, it put paid to the jazz world as it was known back then. And people like my father really found it much, much harder to continue to be in music as a result of the rise of rock and roll. So, it never daunted me that. I always knew that I was destined to be in music, but it certainly gave me a kind of an understanding of what I had to be prepared for.
From that point, you did then go on into music. And is this true that you actually released your first song when you were 17?
Yeah, my first single was released on a soul import label in London. And it had a couple of members from Aswad playing on it. I was a very young, naive young man, and it was called You Fooled Him Once Again. I was a real soul boy back then. I went through all kinds of phases musically, but that was a bit of a soul phase. It was that whole era of British jazz funk, which saw the rise of actually Level 42, Imagination, Lynx, from which David Grant came from, Light of the World, all that kind of thing. So that was a world that I was in for a while. I did a lot of live performing in London. I look back on it now and it was definitely the record, a record made by a very young lad, put it that way. but it was, it was a great experience, really great experience.
Okay. And then a little while after, you then went on to do you was in the band then, Johnny Hates Jazz, which you are back in now. But what was that like, going onto a band after you'd already done your own material?
It was very hard because I had been in other bands, and I've always been inclined to work alone, or at least as a solo artist. Certainly collaborating, but really writing and performing my own material is what I always felt I needed to do. On the other hand, the interesting thing with Johnny Hates Jazz was that it allowed me to be a singer-songwriter and do some of the keyboards. I was the main songwriter, and being lead singer of the band, it meant I had a high degree of creative input. Whereas the other guys, the two other guys, one of whom is still with me in Johnny Hates Jazz, Mike Nocito, were very strong in the production arena. They were producers. It's not to say they didn't play instruments as well. They did, but that was their forte. So it was a natural combination, you know, me as a singer-songwriter and them as producers, and it seemed to work under the umbrella of a band.
So when you first started writing your own music, especially for the band, did you feel that came quite easy, or was that quite a difficult task?
writing is sometimes very fluid and sometimes very challenging, and any songwriter or poet or writer of prose I know says the same thing, and it's very hard to determine on a day-to-day level how you're going to respond to the desire and the need to write. With Johnny Hates Jazz, it revolved around the first song I wrote for the band, which was Shattered Dreams. And Shattered Dreams was an interesting one, because I remember writing it in my parents' front room. And it was the only time my dad came in and asked me what it was that I was writing. I mean, he was always interested and curious, but he really made a point of coming in, and he said, "Well, what is that you're playing?" And I said, "Well, it's this new song I'm working on called Shattered Dreams." And he was quiet, and then he said, "I think you've written your first hit." And he was right. He was the first person to tell me that. A lot of people told me the opposite, by the way. A lot of well-known people in music told me the opposite. But my dad saw it very early on. So because Shattered Dreams, had that kind of support, and certainly Mike and Calvin, who were my partners in the band at the time, felt very strongly about it as well, it kind of opened the floodgates. You know, songwriting a lot is about confidence. If you feel confident in yourself and what you're doing, then you tend to write more. And if you feel insecure about it, you tend to write less. So it was a very confident time.
As you're saying, that song was a hit. It was hit over in the UK. It got to number 5, and even in the US as well, it then went to number 2. How did that feel, knowing that that success was coming from your first single with the band?
It was an interesting thing, because I had worked for many, many years. I mean, you mentioned my first single was released at 17, but I think my first song was written when I was 9 years old. I'm never, ever going to let anyone hear that, believe me. There was a lot of steep learning curve, let me put it that way, for quite a few years. But so it was interesting, because in some ways I thought I would be euphoric with my first success, imagining how I'd feel when that happened. But actually it was more a case of, okay, what next? That's been achieved. How do we build on this? I was very pragmatic about it. I felt obviously very, very good about it, but there was already a sense of how do we take this further? I already had written I Don't Want to Be a Hero and Turn Back the Clock, which were the next two singles after Shattered Dreams. So I was very, very intent on getting I Don't Want to Be a Hero released, because that was probably my favorite song on the album. It wasn't my favorite recording. I think we all felt we could have recorded that one better. But I Don't Want to Be a Hero was a song, just hearing me sit and play it and sing it at a piano, was a meaningful one for me, because it was an anti-war song. And that was a time, as a lot of people will remember, when you could have songs with big statements, big social statements, anti-war statements, environmental statements that were in the charts. That seems to have disappeared now in terms of its presence in the charts. It's more of an entertainment thing now, but music back then was both entertainment but also social commentary. So that was my immediate thought. Okay, how do we get I Don't Want to Be a Hero out?
Shattered Dreams and I Don't Want to Be a Hero was all part of the album Turn Back the Clock, which was, I think, came out about a year after Shattered Dreams was released, but the album went to number one and was just massive worldwide. I mean, how did that feel, knowing that your whole body of work was being as loved as your songs were?
Well, it was wonderful, of course. I think I didn't really understand the gravitas of it until many years later, when we were informed by someone at Virgin Records, who we used to be signed to, that Turn Back the Clock was the only Virgin album, the only one of two Virgin albums to go directly to number one. Excuse me, debut albums, I should say. One of only two debut albums to go directly to number one on Virgin Records ever in its entire history. So one was Turn Back the Clock, the other was Nevermind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols. And when I heard that, it put it into context for me. I thought to myself, wow, you know, that was a that was an achievement. I felt very, very proud at that moment.
I mean, the album is still today, I think, gets mentioned quite a lot, and these songs from it do get played quite a lot as well. So do you feel that that does still have an impact with a lot of people? Do people tell you that they still listen to these tracks quite a lot so many years on?
Oh, yeah, very much. I mean, they listen to the album, you know, start to finish a lot. And Turn Back the Clock was one of those albums where song by song it was strong. You know, there were a few other albums out in the 80s that were like that. ABC's Lexicon of Love was one of them. You know, they were kind of, in some ways, they were defining albums of that time. You know, that people do still very often come up to me and say how much they love the album. Yes, there's a lot of focus on Shattered Dreams or, you know, the other songs sometimes, but it is interesting how people really still relate to it as a body of work, which is gratifying, very gratifying.
And it was only shortly after the album came out that you then actually left the band to then go on to do your solo material. So what was that like then, going back to do your own work again by yourself?
It was an interesting process and a bit strange, because I had left the band incredibly early. We had just achieved a number two in the US. It was actually number one on the adult-oriented, the AOR chart, which was then the adult-oriented rock chart. So I was aware that I had possibly jumped ship too soon. But I'd also, there were a few songs that I was intending to be part of the next Johnny H. Jazz album, which I ended up taking with me. And in some ways, it was a very beautiful experience, because I got to work with some wonderful musicians. Nathan East, who is Eric Clapton's bass player now, but played with Stevie Wonder, Earth, Wind & Fire, lots and lots of people. John Robinson, J.R. Robinson, who was the drummer for Chaka Khan. He was in the band Rufus, Chaka Khan's band, and then played with Michael Jackson and the like. And Paul Jackson Jr. was also with Michael Jackson. So I had a very, very interesting experience playing with those people, performing with those people. But then I think I found that I needed to work with very specific people. And then I started to work with a guy called Rupert Hyde, who produced Tina Turner and Howard Jones and one of my favorite bands at the time, The Fix. And that was that put me in a place where I felt more comfortable, as I was when I was in Johnny H. Jazz.
Yeah, so your solo material was at your first album, Rain Dance, was out in 1990, and then afterwards, is this right that the second album, Fishing for Souls, was unreleased for about 18 years?
Yeah, absolutely. And Rain Dance actually only came out in Japan, where there were two hits from the album. It was a very complicated time, because Virgin was in the process of being sold to EMI. All of the independents were in the process of being sold. In fact, all the majors were starting to be in the process of being sold. So it was a very complicated time. And when I recorded Fishing for Souls, which comprised some tracks from Rain Dance re-recorded, plus some new tracks, this is the album I did with Rupert Hine. My relationship with Virgin wasn't going particularly well. And by the time it came to be released, Virgin was poised to be sold, and it really got lost in the quagmire of that sale. And so it lay on a shelf for a long, long time, and was bootlegged, and became one of the most expensive bootlegs around. you had to pay about £500 for a copy of Fishing for Souls, until I discovered that actually, the ownership had reverted to me, which meant that I could get it back. I did some remixing and then put it out digitally, so that at least it's available. It'll be out on CD again pretty soon as well.
Yeah, so you had that, and then you had the other album, Tomorrow, as well, in 2007. Then just after that, you then returned to Johnny Hates Jazz. So how did it come about, you then going back to the band?
I had written a song for the album Tomorrow, which was called The Road Not Taken. And it was a cathartic song about having to let go of decisions I'd made in the past that maybe hadn't worked out so well. Really is a way of saying that that happens to us all. And there is the incredibly important need to forgive ourselves for things we've done in the past that we feel we could have done differently. So interestingly, I had been thinking about my time at Johnny Hates Jazz. Mike and Calvin had asked me if I'd reform to do some 80s shows, and I just didn't want to. That wasn't my thing. But after a while, having written that song on the album Tomorrow, it kind of put me in the frame of mind of, well, what would a new Johnny Hates Jazz record sound like? So I wrote a song called Magnetized. And when I was working on it, I thought, you know what, I need to play this to the guys. And I did. And, you know, then at that point, it caused a meeting, which, you know, we hadn't spoken to each other for over 20 years. And especially Mike and I, you know, hit it off again very, very easily and started talking about doing a new album. That was an important thing for me. If I was going to perform with the band and do any of the 80s shows, I wanted to make a new album as well. It had to be forward-looking as well. So it revolved around this song, Magnetize, which became the title track of our 2013 album, which was actually just at that point. It was just Mike and myself in Johnny Hates Jazz. So so that's really how it came about. Magnetize, yeah, it's still a, you know, an important record for me.
I've got to say, when I listened to that song, I think it was 2 years ago for when Magnetize came out. I remember hearing it on Radio 2, and I thought it was brilliant. And I didn't realise at first that it was Johnny Hates Jazz. I thought it sounded like it was a new band to me. It sounded like something quite rejuvenated, taking inspiration from the 80s. And when I heard it's Johnny Hates Jazz, I was like, that's brilliant. I've really liked it. So how did that feel when obviously you're almost introducing your music now to a new generation?
It was great because it was received incredibly well at radio. I think better than a lot of our peers, actually, who had stayed together all those years, considering we had split up for so long. No, it did really well. And it was great because you can't help but be affected by the world as it changed. You know, I'm not someone who is kind of locked in the 1980s. I listen to modern music, and of course, that affects me. And so I wanted to bring that into whatever we were doing whilst keeping a foot in the fact that this is a Johnny Hates Jazz record. So, you know, it had certain components that we needed to imbue it with. But I wanted it to be a record that would stand up today. And, we had a lot of younger people who discovered Johnny Hates Jazz through that song, which is great. In some ways, I look back and Magnetize for that album was, you know, the Shattered Dreams of Turn Back the Clock. Of course, the success level was very different. It's a different time now. We don't, you know, measure success in the same way. But it was the, you know, the lead song, and has resonated with a lot of people.
The album came out a couple of years ago. So from that, have you been touring still? Have you still been doing live shows?
After Magnetize was released, I actually became very ill. So everything came to a halt. That was why there was no second single. And then as a way, in the recovery process in 2014, we did some shows as I, you know, got my strength back. 2015 has not been a year of doing much live stuff because we've been involved in other projects. I've been co-writing the new Mike and the Mechanics album with Mike Rutherford. But next year we're going to be doing a tour. Johnny Hates Jazz tour kicks off in early February, February 7th, actually. And we're going to be doing a lot of live work next year. I'm also going to be doing some solo stuff as well. So it's going to be a busy year for live and probably a bit of recording.
So you said that you're currently writing for for Mike and the Mechanics as well.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got to ask, how did that come around, Sess? That's pretty, that's brilliant.
It's interesting because Mike Rutherford and myself have a close mutual friend, Brian Rawlings, who is head of a company called Metrophonic, and Metrophonic are a production company that their most recent success has been with James Bay. Their first success was with Cher, the record Believe, they made that. Very successful company. And Brian used to play drums with Johnny H. Jazz. So Brian knew Mike very well, knows Mike very well, and just made the suggestion, how about doing some writing with Clark Batchelor? And me and Mike Rutherford have met each other, you know, quite a few times back in the late 80s, and he was very into the idea, and it's really turned into, you know, a real proper collaboration for the next album. So a lot of work's going into that. It's very enjoyable. He's, you know, he deserves his legendary status. That the word legend is bandied about way too often these days. But Mike Rutherford is one of those few individuals in music who I think deserves it. And it's been a real eye-opener and inspiring for me to work with him. You can't argue with the amount of time, the decades through which he stayed relevant. And he's kept the bar high. It's always been high-quality music. He's never kind of lowered himself to do something just for the sake of a quick bit of success. It's always been very musical, and I like working with him a lot.
Brilliant. Right, well, Clark, I've got one more question, and I don't know how easy it's going to be, because you've worked with pretty much everyone by the sounds of it, but if you had the opportunity to work with anyone in music, to collaborate with anyone, who would you choose, and why would you choose that person?
That's a really good question. It's, you know, when you think about who you'd collaborate with, what can I say? I'm a massive Stevie Wonder fan. But I don't know if there would be any point in such a collaboration. You know what? He's an incredible singer, incredible keyboard player, incredible writer. So I'm going to say, actually, I would like to collaborate. Wow, what a difficult question. Because I'm just really going through all the people that I love. And I'm not sure if that's necessarily what you're asking. I have this thing about doing a track with the Isley Brothers. Now, there's really only two Isley Brothers left who are performing, one of whom is Ernie Isley, the great guitarist from the Isley Brothers. And I mention him because the Isleys were the epitome of music that I grew up listening to. And that is, they were... they're pop songs, but they had something to say. Harvest for the World is one of my favorite songs ever. And because it was an incredibly meaningful song. It was very socially conscious. And I would like to work with people for whom that is important. And Ernie Isley is just so underrated as a guitarist. You know, we put so much emphasis on Jimi Hendrix. So much emphasis on Prince, so much emphasis on, you know, Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Dave Gilmour. But you know what? Ernie Isley broke the mold in many ways. That guy was, you know, in a soul band for so long, still is, and he was a rock guitarist like Jimmy Page. In fact, Jimmy Page lived with the Isleys as a young man for quite a long time. He played with the Isleys. So Ernie Isley, who was younger than Jimmy Page, obviously, you know, was inspired, but I think that he's someone that needs re-recognizing. So I guess I'd say probably Ernie Isley.
Well, Clark, I'm going to say once again, just a massive thank you. It's been really great to chat to you, to learn more about you. And I'll tell you what, now you've got me excited now for a tour next year and the Mike and Mechanics album. So
great. John Joe, lovely to speak to you. Lovely. Thanks, John Joe. Good questions. Nice speaking to you.
And you too, Clark. Thank you very much. Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye for now.
Bye.